track session number 21564, reel 11.
Colonel Cormac, reel 11. I think you were saying that your orders groups are normally held in the evening, at the end of the working day.
Yes, we would drive in from our troop location, which tended to be as far away from squadron headquarters as I reasonably could be. And then we would have an O group. We would say report what we'd done during the day.
This would be you and the other troop commanders.
All three of us would come in together. Yes. And we would sit down with the IO and the squadron commander. The two IC would be there, because he had to be in the picture. And then we would be told what our jobs were the next day. And mostly it was routine, because route maintenance was the biggest job we had. Maintenance and then construction. But it was keeping the routes open, and it would be, you're on green 1, 2 and 3 tomorrow, and that, as you have been, and so on and so forth. And then special jobs came up, like mine laying, which didn't happen every day, but happened regularly, and they were shared out. And then special jobs like that bridge, who was running the water point, was all discussed and orders given out, and you took your notes. Then there would be a social chat and possibly a glass of beer, and then we would motor back to our troops. And then I would write up my own little notes, decide who I was going to have on certain jobs. And I didn't chop and change too much. I mean, if Section 1 was doing a certain stretch of road, then I left them to it and was merely confirmed that they would carry on that stretch. And then it would be someone's turn to run the water point. That would be arranged and so on. And then any comments about the background, anything that the briefing I'd been given as to the overall situation, they would be told that all was quiet or that there had been trouble in the next division. They would be told in general terms, you know, what the situation was, so that they were in the picture and knew as much really as I did. That was the whole idea.
How long would that process take, the normal O group process?
Not terribly long. The one at squadron would take an hour to an hour and a half, perhaps, depending on the urgency of the situation and what things, and if there was time for a drink afterwards, that would be fine, just a chat about things generally. And quite often, the CO might come drop in on an O group just to see what was going on and add his bit. We didn't often go to regimental headquarters at my level. It all came through. But occasionally you went in to see the adjutant at RHQ or the IO or the signals officer if there was something special going on. But that was comparatively rare.
And you would then go back. Would you have a troop O group?
Yes, that's what I would. Having written up my little notes.
Yes. Who would be in the troop O group?
My troop sergeant, yes. My recce sergeant, the three section commanders. And anybody else that I thought might be involved, who would need to know, especially, and that you might have someone attached to you for a while. And that, again, just took as long as it took to pass them over, pass the information over, get questions in, confirm that they were all quite happy. Any news, any reports about the troop, anyone not well, that sort of thing, and anyone we should be worried about. It's a chance to discuss all that.
You were saying earlier on there wasn't much in the way of paperwork for administration. And did you ever get formal written orders, or were orders normally issued on a verbal basis?
Verbally, yes. I don't know. I think I showed you that message form. And that was one of the few that I had a message pad. I had one or two more. That was when I was involved in the infantry role with the rifle battalions, yes. They were a bit more, there wasn't much written, but they were keen in passing messages across like that. Most of my staff came either from the O group or over the radio or by telephone.
Did you keep a telephone and radio log of signals in and out?
No, I didn't. No, I just... I just took notes, and I had a pad in my side pocket there.
Yes.
And I just took notes of any instructions by radio, but they were usually very brief. Thank goodness. We were not used to writing much like that. I did one report on a route recce with another officer, a friend of mine, Linton Whiteman, and we had to write out a formal report. I think that was the only one I did. Mostly it was just notes that I used. The log of information was kept at squadron headquarters. That was the lowest level that a formal log was kept.
When you were being briefed on the general situation, did the IO or the CO or whoever was doing the briefing use a map board as the basic equipment?
Yes, they had, in the office truck or tent, whatever we were using at the time, there would be a map of the area with all the routes on it. All the minefields that we had done and planned minefields would all be there, so that you could see. And they were all on my own map anyway. I had that available to me, and I knew where all the routes, because they were all code numbered with letters, and pink 1, green 2, blue 4. And the reporting system was kept as simple as possible. All the pieces of plant that we had available were all code named.
Yes.
And if you wanted a thing, you'd say, could I have Crusader tomorrow or whatever? And a very simple system and easy to follow.
Was that done for reasons of security? Were you concerned about field security? And
it was signal security, generally, yes.
Yeah.
It was a convenient form of notation as well,
of course,
as much as anything else.
When you were speaking on the wireless, on the radio, did you use any sort of code or just speak in clear?
We used simple code. We had a thing called Slidex available to us, but I'm happy to say we didn't actually use it very much. It was a cumbersome procedure.
Mm.
I think possibly from squadron to regimental headquarters or at divisional level, they might have used it there a bit. I don't really know. Mm. But no, our procedure was modified to suit American conditions. We still use Sunray, Seagull, Hold Fast for Sappers, the usual things, Pronto for signals. We used all those code words, but the framework of our wireless procedure was American.
How did that differ from British?
Mainly in the use of names.
Yeah.
I can't pluck an example out of the air at the moment. But we would be something, I was True Troop would be Swallow 2, something like that, but it wasn't Swallow. But it was something like that which we didn't use, but we found very easy to get the hang of. And it was a sort of mixture between the two.
It must have been almost incomprehensible to anyone trying to listen in.
Hopefully.
Have a mixture of a British and American signals language and procedure.
It was so very similar, really. Roger, Wilco, they were universal words, and the alphabet. In those days, of course, it was Abel Baker Charlie Dog. We then moved on to Alpha Bravo, but the Americans had used that. It all fell from the World War II.
When you're using field telephone, did you treat that as if it was secure, or were you also precautionary as far as that was concerned?
You didn't worry too much about security on the telephone, to be honest, really. You were just sensible, but no, there was no special security on the telephone.
Mm.
It was very handy, provided you were within range to run the cable out. And I should think the whole area was littered with Don R cable for years to come.
On the whole, did you find the wireless sets you got were reliable and effective?
Not terribly. The 88 sets were not too bad for short range work.
Yeah. What would you mean by short range? What sort of distance?
Oh, just a mile or two. A
mile or two.
For work on a minefield area and contacting your protection parties when they were in the right place, that sort of thing, and little outposts, it was good for that. We had 19 sets. And then 62 sets, which were slightly better.
Yes.
They tended to go off. The 19 set particularly, when it was mounted in a Jeep, and you had the sort of wireless Jeep, you had a sort of frame on the back, and I would have myself the driver, and he was the radio operator as well. Occasionally you would have an operator sitting in the back, but more often it was just myself and my driver. And the difficulty was bouncing along these rough-ish roads was keeping the thing on net.
Well, it would just slip off.
It would just, the vibrations, the thing would, yeah. And tuning it and getting it on net so you could hear clearly was a constant battle. Because the favourite saying was, my batteries are failing out, when you didn't want to hear anything. They worked. But it was tricky, and compared to modern equipment, it was really archaic. The 62 slightly better, but similar problems.
It's my impression that every generation thinks that they have not yet managed to produce a truly reliable radio set.
I would think that's a fair summary, but. Having gone through, like many of us, from these older sets to the newer ones, you could see the marked improvement. The telephone set that we had with a little exchange, I think it was an American one, with a handle and so on and plugs in, when I was in BOR later on and you had the Bruin system coming in, you could actually get around a lot better. It still wasn't perfect, but it was, if you had known the previous system, it was an improvement, a marked improvement.
Better than before.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Mm. And I'm told the new ones will be even better if and when they come.
How did you actually get back home from Korea? What was the procedure for?
Well, I was slightly damaged.
Damaged? How did that happen?
And I had some trouble when I was blown up in the tank. And then we were under fire and we were moving around, I was blown into a slit trench. It went in fairly involuntary, and my leg got caught.
Was this during Operation Commando?
No. This was much, much later on.
This
was 1952.
I don't think you told me that you've been blown up on a tank. What happened?
I think I mentioned that earlier on. It was at the start of Commando, when we were setting off from the FUP, and I think I had mentioned that we were going along one of these Japanese roads, and I was sitting on the tank with the troop commander, and he thought it would be a useful idea if we went off the road, and it was a bend,
yes.
And the surface of the road hadn't been disturbed in any way, so I thought, well, maybe it's all right. But they had actually, that bend, put some mortars underneath. I think I had mentioned that.
I think you did, yes. It was an improvised mine, yeah. Wasn't it? Yes.
And when it went up, we were shot in the air and came, yes, banging down.
And you'd hurt your leg in the process.
My back.
Your back. Yeah.
And my leg. But it was all right. And then I had another accident. There was a bit of shell fire. I can't remember exactly now, but I know I went into a slit trench in an unconventional way. And damaged the knee, my ankle rather, and it was one that I had injured playing rugby before, and I think that exacerbated that. Anyway, I'm beginning to find it very difficult to walk after that, and so I went out. Our MO said, "That's it. I'm afraid you're not going to be able to limp around and be a troop commander."
Yes.
So I went to the Indian Field Ambulance, which was a wonderful thing, 60th Indian Field Ambulance. That was a prime unit in the division, Colonel Rangaraj for the Indian. So they're all parachute trained. They had a tremendous reputation. And he examined my leg and said, "No, it's hopeless. You're not going to get any better." And then I went from there to Normash, that was the Norwegian Mobile Army Surgical Hospital. That was super. They were also extremely good. That was the Norwegian contribution. And there they x-rayed it and said, "Yep, what you had is a POTS fracture caused by," and there's some old injuries there too.
So it was a new injury on top of an old injury.
That's right, caused by that. And so I was there for a short while. That's when I nearly got my Purple Heart, because they came around. And all Americans who are wounded get a Purple Heart. And they were dishing them out. Then they realized, of course, I wasn't American, so they took it away again very quickly. But I remember that, just a by the way. But my time in Normash was fairly short, but it was enough to give me a lifelong appreciation of that wonderful TV series called MASH.
What was the setup at Normash then? Was it like the setup in the TV series? Was it a sort of tented?
Yes, exactly.
Surgical hospital.
These greeny tents.
Yes,
it was exactly like that. The Norwegians, I would say off the record, were slightly more formal. And they were very efficient, very caring, and inspired enormous confidence. Mm. But the sort of general background to people coming in, helicopters landing, casualties being rushed in, that sort of thing, was so near the mark that I always enjoyed MASH. I could appreciate just what was happening there.
What sort of treatment did they give you in the Normash?
So they just strapped up my leg, and I was resting there and really just waiting until I could be evacuated. And then I went down to the Canadian field dressing station. That was another thing. And there they just again, I was just had to rest, and I couldn't get around.
What was the idea that the fracture, if immobilized, would eventually heal itself?
I don't think they had too much idea about that.
They didn't.
It was just there. And then I was there again just for a couple of days until the train. Mm. We went down by ambulance train to Pusan, across on boat, and finished up at the BMH at Curie. And that was when they really gave me the treatment for the leg.
What did they do with you at the BMH?
Well, they just had a quick look and an operation just to see what was there. And then I was plastered up.
So it was an exploratory operation to examine.
Make sure there was no bits of bone.
Yes.
Because the Pott's fracture, I think, was part of the outside breaks off.
Yes.
And that had been done before, and that was the sort of thing. But it gave me an experience of going through the medical evacuation system.
How did they move you between these various establishments, the Indian, the Norwegian, the Canadian, and the British?
Ambulance. Mm. They had, at that stage, it was so they had Jeep ambulances.
Yes.
I was the MO took me to the Indian Field Ambulance, and there afterwards it was ambulance down to Seoul, down to Normash, and then to Seoul, and then ambulance train.
What was the Indian Field Hospital? Was that
Field Ambulance?
Field
yeah.
Ambulance. Were they under canvas as well?
Was yes, they were all under canvas. Mm. It was only the field dressing station run by the Canadians that had that was a solid building, and that had been commandeered from something, I can't remember now exactly, possibly an old Japanese building, because there weren't many solid buildings around. But that was a structure I can remember. And the BMH in Curie was a proper hospital. That was very good.
Were all the procedures in these medical units standardized? Was there a standard procedure for
it? Well, again, I was
dealing with you when you arrived.
So concerned, really. Mm. I just once you're in the system, then that's what, particularly in a medical way, that's what happens. You just go through.
You're just a passive object then.
You were an object, yes, and certainly given proper care and attention. Mm. But you weren't consulted if you'd like, would you like to go to Normash or would you like to, you just went.
Yes.
And you were done, and then to the BMH at Curie, and then that was it. Once my leg was in plaster, they did one or two other little things to me there, but that was not important. And then rehabilitation. I went to, after I'd been there for some time, and then the plaster came off, and they thought, well, you need physiotherapy and other treatment like that. And they had a rehabilitation center where I then had my foot into baths with electric charges through, and then physiotherapy and exercise to get myself back.
How long did it take to actually restore?
It was
mobility and strength.
A few weeks.
A few weeks. Mm. And this all happening in Curie?
It all happened, yes. That's where most of it was done. The rest was just, it wasn't, one wasn't too clear about the time at various places, just a series of impressions of being, you know, pretty well looked after. And getting occasional huge inoculations of penicillin at various times. I think that was in Normash, that's what happened there. The routine system of making sure everyone was going to be all right.
Yes.
But I was, my overall impression, I was very impressed with the medical backup that was available to us there. It really was very good. Very dedicated bunch of people, that's the impression. And the people at certainly at Curie, at the end, when I was there most, couldn't have been better. They were really good.
What happened to you after you'd recovered? Did you go back to England?
I went to the Australian Engineer Regiment in Curie.
Ah, what were they doing?
Well, they had been there from the occupation, and really, well, I was just waiting for a boat home. And I spent a few weeks there, again, just making myself useful and getting fit until I got a boat home in January 53.
What sort of things did they ask you to do to make yourself useful while you were...
Well, I spent some time with the CO and the 2IC, very nice chaps, and Peter Jackson, he's now a brigadier, he retired, but he's still alive. But Don Cooper, the 2IC, was a very extrovert sort of chap, very popular with the engineers overall. I was helping him on some minor projects, and then I said I'd really like to do something more constructive, and I had two or three weeks in the stores section.
Yes.
And I did a project there on getting engineer stores for Korea, because by December 52, there was a possibility of an armistice, although it took another 6 months to achieve. But there was a need for more conventional engineer supplies coming through, because they thought, well, divisional headquarters and the other establishments are going to be long-term, who knows? So I scoured the world, literally, for materials, and that was, I got catalogue lists of stuff from Malaya, UK, wherever, and that was a project I had to order those by proper engineer catalogue numbers and requirements, and did a short project on that.
This is really stock management, isn't it?
It really was. And to make sure that, and to find out what they had there too, because there were great dumps of stuff.
Yes.
And there was a big engineer stores place there. And I found stuff that had been dumped there by, I think it was 17 Indian Division, who had been part of the British occupation force for a while before the Australians took over the main responsibility. And there were all sorts of things like gigantic rice boilers for making massive amounts of rice for the Indians. But that was interesting. And then I sailed home and had 7 weeks in a boat on the Lancashire.
When you were doing this project on the stores, how did you get an idea of what would be required? Did you go to the CRE at Division or the Chief Royal Engineer at Division?
They had sent a brief to the Australian Engineer Regiment as to what they thought they might require.
And you were investigating
and
availability.
Where it could come from. And clearly, the nearest source was Malaya, although they were having trouble at that time, 52, 53, 54.
Of course. What about Hong Kong? Was there nothing
but
there?
Hong Kong didn't have the same amount of supplies. But we tapped everywhere. I mean, it was Hong Kong, Malaya strongly, and BOR in UK.
Singapore, was that a...?
That was part of Malaya.
Part of Malaya,
that was before Malaysia became. That was part of the... I have to say that what I heard later on, that some of the areas took the opportunity to offload all their rubbish. But
What sort of rubbish would they be able to offload on you?
Paint that they could never use.
Paint?
Paint as things got more static, and then peacetime accounting might be drifting in, paint would become very important. That was it. Various timbers. And the range of timbers that one... was offered, I mean, some timber from Malaya, which was extremely good, hard wood, and others. The range of stuff was incredible that could be made available. Supplies of cement. I had all the papers. I had a copy for years just for fun, but I don't know what happened to that. But that was a little project I did on the, before I went home.
Did this material start to arrive before you got on the ship home? So you'd done the administration.
It took time to get the paperwork and then send out demands.
You didn't see the results of this?
No. It'd be nice if I had, but that was... It was just a sensible way of occupying or being occupied while waiting for the boat home.
While you'd been in Korea, had you been able to keep in touch with home regularly by...
Mail?
Post.
Yes. Well, the mail system was very good. Mm-hmm. Very good indeed. We had free mail because we had these letter, these air letter forms. Mm-hmm. And that was most of it. And they went backwards and forwards wherever we moved around. It took a little time to catch up when you were evacuated, but no, it soon caught up, and the postal system worked very well indeed. Mm-hmm. Lessons learned during World War II, and particularly Burma, of how to make sure the supply of mail gets through, had obviously borne fruit, and that worked extremely well.
What sort of ship did they put you on to go home? Was it a trooper or was it a liner?
Troop ship, yes, troop ship. It was an old British India boat called the Lancashire, HT, Her Majesty's Troop Ship Lancashire. Great. It was British India Line. It was clearly Far Eastern run. It was perfectly adequate. We were very relaxed. And we had what amounted to a nice six-week cruise.
Did you make any stops on the way?
Hong Kong. Yes, we stopped. We went from Curie back to Busan to pick up some who were coming out direct, who hadn't been. They were posted home from Korea and they hadn't come through the hospital system or whatever, and then Hong Kong, Singapore, Colombo, Aden, traditional route really.
It's the traditional sea trooping route, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely, yes. Which is most people have forgotten now. Mm. And then portside, we didn't get into Malta, we got into the Grand Harbour and the Piper was there, but there was a polio scare. So we weren't allowed to get into Malta, which was a great disappointment. And then, because of bad weather in the Mediterranean, we lost time. We had to turn about and go back eastwards for a bit. We weren't allowed to get off at Gibraltar. So we sailed past Gibraltar, which was equally sad, and then eventually got home to Liverpool.
You said you then had some leave before you went off to your next... appointment. What was the next appointment?
Then I went down. I went to Aldershot, and started to expand and form up a boys' training squad, boy soldiers.
Did you feel a sort of sense of anticlimax coming back to Aldershot, having been out in an active
inevitably,
theatre?
Yes, inevitably. Mm. I mean, I suppose they thought that it would be good for the boys to have someone who'd just come back from active service as a figure in charge. It was an interesting situation in some respects, because there had been a boys' troop, but they were all trumpeters.
Yes.
Who played at various formal things, and they were given a little education, a little support, and then sent. Half of them had been volunteered for the boys' service, half had been given the option of borstal or go to the army. But what it in effect was the forerunner of the junior leaders training system. Mm. And we expanded this little squadron. And then it was my opposite number across the road, the RASC boys squadron. Mm. And that was the beginnings of the junior leader training system, which I think has probably been changed again completely now. But that ran for quite a few years. That boys squadron that we formed and built up then became the Junior Leaders Regiment, which finished up at Dover.
How many of them were there in it when you arrived and took it over?
We must have had nearly